results. Introverted patients responded better and interacted longer with robots that were designed to speak in a soothing, gentle manner. I know it is hard, but remember that it's for your own good. And, very nice, keep up the good work. Extroverts, on the other hand, worked harder for robots that used more bracing, aggressive language. You can do more than that, I know it. And concentrate on your exercise. These findings suggest that Greg and Emily face an interesting challenge. If Greg likes people more when they're behaving forcefully or competitively, and if Emily feels the same way about nurturing, cooperative people, then how can they reach a compromise about their dinner party impasse and get there in a loving way? An intriguing answer comes from a University of Michigan business school study, not of married couples with opposite personality styles, but of negotiators from different cultures, in this case Asians and Israelis. 76 MBA students from Hong Kong and Israel were asked to imagine they were getting married in a few months and had to finalize arrangements with a catering company for the wedding reception. This meeting took place by video. Some of the students were shown a video in which the business manager was friendly and smiley. The others saw a video featuring an irritable and antagonistic manager. But the caterer's message was the same in both cases. Another couple was interested in the same wedding date. The price had gone up. Take it or leave it. The students from Hong Kong reacted very differently from the Israeli students. The Asians were far more likely to accept a proposal from the friendly business manager than from the hostile one. Only 14% were willing to work with the difficult manager, while 71% accepted the deal from the smiling caterer. But the Israelis were just as likely to accept the deal from either manager. In other words, for the Asian negotiators, style counted as well as substance, while the Israelis were more focused on the information being conveyed. They were unmoved by a display of either sympathetic or hostile emotions. The explanation for this stark difference has to do with how the two cultures define respect. As we saw in Chapter 8, many Asian people show esteem by minimizing conflict. But Israelis, say the researchers, are not likely to view disagreement as a sign of disrespect, but as a signal that the opposing party is concerned and is passionately engaged in the task. We might say the same of Greg and Emily. When Emily lowers her voice and flattens her affect during fights with Greg, she thinks she's being respectful by taking the trouble not to let her negative emotions show. But Greg thinks she's checking out, or, worse, that she doesn't give a damn. Similarly, when Greg lets his anger fly, he assumes that Emily feels, as he does, that this is a healthy and honest expression of their deeply committed relationship. But to Emily, it's as if Greg has suddenly turned on her. In her book, Anger, The Misunderstood Emotion, Carol Tavris recounts a story about a Bengali cobra that liked to bite passing villagers. One day, a swami, a man who has achieved self-mastery, convinces the snake that biting is wrong. The cobra vows to stop immediately, and does. Before long, the village boys grow unafraid of the snake and start to abuse him. Battered and bloodied, the snake complains to the swami that this is what came of keeping his promise. "I told you not to bite," said the swami, "but I did not tell you not to hiss." Many people, like the swami's cobra, confuse the hiss with the bite, writes Tavris. Many people, like Greg and Emily, both have much to learn from the swami's story. Greg to stop biting. Emily, that it's okay for him and for her, to hiss. Greg can start by changing his assumptions about anger. He believes, as most of us do, that venting anger lets off steam. The catharsis hypothesis, that aggression builds up inside us until it's healthily released, dates back to the Greeks, was revived by Freud, and gained steam during the let-it-all-hang-out 1960s of punching bags and primal screams. But the catharsis hypothesis is a myth, a plausible one, an elegant one, but a myth nonetheless. Scores of studies have shown that venting doesn't soothe anger. It fuels it. We're best off when we don't allow ourselves to go to our angry place. Amazingly, neuroscientists have even found that people who use Botox, which prevents them from making angry faces, seem to be less anger-prone than those who don't, because the very act of frowning triggers the amygdala to process negative emotions. And anger is not just damaging in the moment. For days afterward, venters have repair work to do with their partners. Despite the popular fantasy of fabulous sex after fighting, many couples say that it takes time to feel loving again. What can Greg do to calm down when he feels his fury mounting? He can take a deep breath. He can take a 10-minute break. And he can ask himself whether the thing that's making him so angry is really that important. If not, he might let it go. But if it is, then he'll want to phrase his needs not as personal attacks, but as neutral discussion items. "You're so antisocial" can become, "Can we figure out a way to organize our weekends that works for us both?" This advice would hold even if Emily weren't a sensitive introvert. No one likes to feel dominated or disrespected. But it so happens that Greg's married to a woman who is especially put off by anger. So he needs to respond to the conflict-avoidant wife he has, not the confrontational one that he wishes, at least in the heat of the moment, he were married to. Now let's look at Emily's side of the equation. What could she be doing differently? She's right to protest when Greg bites, when he attacks unfairly. But what about when he hisses? Emily might address her own counterproductive reactions to anger, among them her tendency to slip into a cycle of guilt and defensiveness. We know from Chapter 6 that many introverts are prone from earliest childhood to strong guilt feelings. We also know that we all tend to project our own reactions onto others. Because conflict-avoidant Emily would never bite or even hiss unless Greg had done something truly horrible, on some level, she processes his bite to mean that she's terribly guilty of something, anything, who knows what. Emily's guilt feels so intolerable that she tends to deny the validity of all of Greg's claims, the legitimate ones along with those exaggerated by anger. This, of course, leads to a vicious cycle in which she shuts down her natural empathy and Greg feels unheard. So Emily needs to accept that it's okay to be in the wrong. At first she may have trouble puzzling out when she is and when she isn't. The fact that Greg expresses his grievances with such passion makes it hard to sort this out. But Emily must try not to get dragged into this morass. When Greg makes legitimate points, she should acknowledge them, not only to be a good partner to her husband, but also to teach herself that it's okay to have transgressed. This will make it easier for her not to feel hurt and to fight back when Greg's claims are unjustified. Fight back? But Emily hates fighting. That's okay. She needs to become more comfortable with the sound of her own hiss. Introverts may be hesitant to cause disharmony, but, like the passive snake, they should be equally worried about encouraging vitriol from their partners. And fighting back may not invite retaliation, as Emily fears. Instead, it may encourage Greg to back off. She need not put on a huge display. Often, a firm, "That's not okay with me," will do. Every once in a while, Emily might also want to step outside her usual comfort zone and let her own anger fly. Remember, for Greg, heat means connection. In the same way that the extroverted players in the football game study felt warmly toward their fellow competitors, so Greg may feel closer to Emily if she can take on just a little of the coloration of a pumped-up player, ready to take the field. Emily can also overcome her own distaste for Greg's behavior by reminding herself that he's not really as aggressive as he seems. John, an introvert I interviewed who has a great relationship with his fiery wife, describes how he learned to do this after 25 years of marriage. When Jennifer's after me about something, she's really after me. If I went to bed without tidying the kitchen, the next morning she'll shout at me, "This kitchen is filthy." I come in and look around the kitchen. There are 3 or 4 cups out. It's not filthy. But the drama with which she imbues such moments is natural to her. That's her way of saying, "Gee, when you get a chance, I'd appreciate it if you could just tidy up the kitchen a little more." If she did say it that way to me, I would say, "I'd be happy to, and I'm sorry that I didn't do it sooner." But because she comes at me with that 200-mile-per-hour freight train energy, I want to bridle and say, "Too bad." The reason I don't is because we've been married for 25 years, and I've come to understand that Jennifer didn't put me in a life-threatening situation when she spoke that way. So what's John's secret for relating to his forceful wife? He lets her know that her words were unacceptable, but he also tries to listen to their meaning. "I try to tap into my empathy," he says. "I take her tone out of the equation. I take out the assault on my senses, and I try to get to what she's trying to say." And what Jennifer is trying to say, underneath her freight train words, is often quite simple. Respect me. Pay attention to me. Love me. Greg and Emily now have valuable insights about how to talk through their differences. But there's one more question they need to answer. Why exactly do they experience those Friday night dinner parties so differently? We know that Emily's nervous system probably goes into overdrive when she enters a room full of people. And we know that Greg feels the opposite. Propelled toward people, conversations, events, anything that gives him that dopamine-fueled, go-for-it sensation that extroverts crave. But let's dig a little deeper into the anatomy of cocktail hour chatter. The key to bridging Greg and Emily's differences lies in the details. Some years ago, 32 pairs of introverts and extroverts, all of them strangers to each other, chatted on the phone for a few minutes as part of an experiment conducted by a neuroscientist named Dr. Matthew Lieberman, then a graduate student at Harvard. When they hung up, they were asked to fill out detailed questionnaires, rating how they'd felt and behaved during the conversation. How much did you like your conversational partner? How friendly were you? How much would you like to interact with this person again? They were also asked to put themselves in the shoes of their conversational partners. How much did your partner like you? How sensitive was she to you? How encouraging? Lieberman and his team compared the answers and also listened in on the conversations and made their own judgments about how the parties felt about each other. They found that the extroverts were a lot more accurate than the introverts in assessing whether their partner liked talking to them. These findings suggest that extroverts are better at decoding social cues than introverts. "At first, this seems unsurprising," writes Lieberman. "It echoes the popular assumption that extroverts are better at reading social situations. The only problem, as Lieberman showed through a further twist to his experiment, is that this assumption is not quite right." Lieberman and his team asked a select group of participants to listen to a tape of the conversations they'd just had before filling out the questionnaire. In this group, he found there was no difference between introverts and extroverts in their ability to read social cues. Why? The answer is that the subjects who listened to the tape recording were able to decode social cues without having to do anything else at the same time. And introverts are pretty fine decoders, according to several studies predating the Lieberman experiments. One of these studies actually found that introverts were better decoders than extroverts. But these studies measured how well introverts observe social dynamics, not how well they participate in them. Participation places a very different set of demands on the brain than observing does. It requires a kind of mental multitasking. The ability to process a lot of short-term information at once without becoming distracted or overly stressed. This is just the sort of brain functioning that extroverts tend to be well suited for. In other words, extroverts are sociable because their brains are good at handling competing demands on their attention, which is just what dinner party conversation involves. In contrast, introverts often feel repelled by social events that force them to attend to many people at once. Consider that the simplest social interaction between two people requires performing an astonishing array of tasks. Interpreting what the other person is saying, reading body language and facial expressions, smoothly taking turns talking and listening, responding to what the other person said, assessing whether you're being understood, determining whether you're well received, and if not, figuring out how to improve or remove yourself from the situation. Think of what it takes to juggle all this at once, and that's just a one-on-one conversation. Now imagine the multitasking required in a group setting, like a dinner party. So when introverts assume the observer role, as when they write novels, or contemplate unified field theory, or fall quiet at dinner parties, they're not demonstrating a failure of will or a lack of energy. They're simply doing what they're constitutionally suited for. The Lieberman experiment helps us understand what trips up introverts socially. It doesn't show us how they can shine. Consider the case of an unassuming-looking fellow named John Berghoff. John is a stereotypical introvert, right down to his physical appearance, lean, wiry body, sharply etched nose and cheekbones, thoughtful expression on his bespectacled face. He's not much of a talker, but what he says is carefully considered, especially when he's in a group. If I'm in a room with 10 people, and I have a choice between talking and not talking, he says, I'm the one not talking. When people ask, why aren't you saying anything? I'm the guy they're saying it to. John is also a standout salesman, and has been ever since he was a teenager. In the summer of 1999, when he was still a junior in high school, he started working as an entry-level distributor, selling Cutco kitchen products. The job had him going into customers' homes, selling knives. It was one of the most intimate sales situations imaginable, not in a boardroom or a car dealership, but inside a potential client's kitchen, selling them a product they'd use daily to help put food on the table. Within John's first 8 weeks on the job, he sold $50,000 worth of knives. He went on to be the company's top representative from over 40,000 new recruits that year. By the year 2000, when he was still a high school senior, John had generated more than $135,000 in commissions and had broken more than 25 national and regional sales records. Meanwhile, back in high school, he was still a socially awkward guy who hid inside the library at lunchtime. But by 2002, he'd recruited, hired, and trained 90 other sales reps and increased territory sales 500% over the previous year. Since then, John has launched Global Empowerment Coaching, his own personal coaching and sales training business. To date, he's given hundreds of speeches, training seminars, and private consultations to more than 30,000 salespeople and managers. What's the secret of John's success? One important clue comes from an experiment by the developmental psychologist Avril Thorne, now a professor at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Thorne gathered 52 young women, 26 introverts and 26 extroverts, and assigned them to two different conversational pairings. Each person had one 10-minute conversation with a partner of her own type, and a second conversation of equal length with her dispositional opposite. Thorne's team taped the conversations and asked the participants to listen to a playback tape. This process revealed some surprising findings. The introverts and extroverts participated about equally, giving the lie to the idea that introverts always talk less. But the introvert pairs tended to focus on one or two serious subjects of conversation, while the extrovert pairs chose lighter-hearted and wider-ranging topics. Often the introverts discussed problems or conflicts in their lives, school, work, friendships, and so on. perhaps because of this fondness for problem talk. They tended to adopt the role of advisor, taking turns counseling each other on the problem at hand. The extroverts, by contrast, were more likely to offer casual information about themselves that established commonality with the other person. You have a new dog? That's great. A friend of mine has an amazing tank of saltwater fish. But the most interesting part of Thorne's experiment was how much the two types appreciated each other. Introverts talking to extroverts chose cheerier topics, reported making conversation more easily, and described conversing with extroverts as a breath of fresh air. In contrast, the extroverts felt that they could relax more with introvert partners and were freer to confide their problems. They didn't feel pressure to be falsely upbeat. These are useful pieces of social information. Introverts and extroverts sometimes feel mutually put off, but Thorne's research suggests how much each has to offer the other. Extroverts need to know that introverts, who often seem to disdain the superficial, may be only too happy to be tugged along to a more lighthearted place. And introverts, who sometimes feel as if their propensity for problem talk makes them a drag, should know that they make it safe for others to get serious. Thorne's research also helps us to understand John Berghoff's astonishing success at sales. He has turned his affinity for serious conversation and for adopting an advisory role rather than a persuasive one into a kind of therapy for his prospects. I discovered early on that people don't buy from me because they understand what I'm selling, explains John. They buy because they feel understood. John also benefits from his natural tendency to ask a lot of questions and to listen closely to the answers. I got to the point where I could walk into someone's house, and instead of trying to sell them some knives, I'd ask 100 questions in a row. I could manage the entire conversation just by asking the right questions. Today, in his coaching business, John does the same thing. I try to tune into the radio station of the person I'm working with. I pay attention to the energy they exude. It's easy for me to do that because I'm in my head a lot anyways. But doesn't salesmanship require the ability to get excited, to pump people up? Not according to John. A lot of people believe that selling requires being a fast talker or knowing how to use charisma to persuade. Those things do require an extroverted way of communicating. But in sales, there's a truism that we have two ears and one mouth, and we should use them proportionately. I believe that's what makes someone really good at selling or consulting. The number one thing is they've got to really listen well. When I look at the top salespeople in my organization, none of those extroverted qualities are the key to their success. And now back to Greg and Emily's impasse. We've just acquired two crucial pieces of information. First, Emily's distaste for conversational multitasking is real and explicable. And second, when introverts are able to experience conversations in their own way, they make deep and enjoyable connections with others. It was only once they accepted these two realities that Greg and Emily found a way to break their stalemate. Instead of focusing on the number of dinner parties they'd give, they started talking about the format of the parties. Instead of seating everyone around a big table, which would require the kind of all-hands conversational multitasking Emily dislikes so much, why not serve dinner buffet-style, with people eating in small, casual, conversational groupings on the sofas and floor pillows? This would allow Greg to gravitate to his usual spot at the center of the room, and Emily to hers on the outskirts, where she could have the kind of intimate, one-on-one conversations she enjoys. This issue solved, the couple was now free to address the thornier question of how many parties to give. After some back and forth, they agreed on 2 evenings a month, 24 dinners a year, instead of 52. Emily still doesn't look forward to these events, but she sometimes enjoys them in spite of herself. And Greg gets to host the evenings he enjoys so much, to hold on to his identity, and to be with the person he most adores, all at the same time. Chapter 11 On Cobblers and Generals How to Cultivate Quiet Kids in a World That Can't Hear Them. With anything young and tender, the most important part of the task is the beginning of it. For that is the time at which the character is being formed and the desired impression more readily taken. Plato, The Republic. Mark Twain once told a story about a man who scoured the planet looking for the greatest general who ever lived. When the man was informed that the person he sought had already died and gone to heaven, he made a trip to the pearly gates to look for him. St. Peter pointed at a regular-looking Joe. "That isn't the greatest of all generals," protested the man. "I knew that person when he lived on Earth, and he was only a cobbler." "I know that," said St. Peter. "But if he had been a general, he would have been the greatest of them all." We should all look out for cobblers who might have been great generals, which means focusing on introverted children whose talents are too often stifled, whether at home, at school, or on the playground. Consider this cautionary tale, told to me by Dr. Jerry Miller, a child psychologist and the director of the Center for the Child and the Family at the University of Michigan. Dr. Miller had a patient named Ethan, whose parents brought him for treatment on four separate occasions. Each time, the parents voiced the same fears that something was wrong with their child. Each time, Dr. Miller assured them that Ethan was perfectly fine. The reason for their initial concern was simple enough. Ethan was 7, and his 4-year-old brother had beaten him up several times. Ethan didn't fight back. His parents, both of them outgoing, take-charge types with high-powered corporate jobs and a passion for competitive golf and tennis, were okay with their younger son's aggression, but worried that Ethan's passivity was going to be the story of his life. As Ethan grew older, his parents tried in vain to instill fighting spirit in him. They sent him onto the baseball diamond and the soccer field, but Ethan just wanted to go home and read. He wasn't even competitive at school. Though very bright, he was a B student. He could have done better, but preferred to focus on his hobbies, especially building model cars. He had a few close friends, but was never in the thick of classroom social life. Unable to account for his puzzling behavior, Ethan's parents thought he might be depressed. But Ethan's problem, says Dr. Miller, was not depression, but a classic case of poor parent-child fit. Ethan was tall, skinny, and unathletic. He looked like a stereotypical nerd. His parents were sociable, assertive people who were always smiling, always talking to people while dragging Ethan along behind them. Compare their worries about Ethan to Dr. Miller's assessment. He was like the classic Harry Potter kid. He was always reading, says Dr. Miller enthusiastically. He enjoyed any form of imaginative play. He loved to build things. He had so many things he wanted to tell you about. He had more acceptance of his parents than they had of him. He didn't define them as pathological, just as different from himself. That same kid, in a different home, would be a model child. But Ethan's own parents never found a way to see him in that light. The last thing Dr. Miller heard was that his parents finally consulted with another psychologist who agreed to treat their son. And now Dr. Miller is the one who's worried about Ethan. This is a clear case of an iatrogenic problem, he says. That's when the treatment makes you sick. The classic example is when you use treatment to try to make a gay child into a straight one. I worry for that kid. These parents are very caring and well-meaning people. They feel that without treatment, they're not preparing their son for society, that he needs more fire in him. Maybe there's truth to that last part. I don't know. But whether there is or not, I firmly believe that it's impossible to change that kid. I worry that they're taking a perfectly healthy boy and damaging his sense of self. Of course, it doesn't have to be a bad fit when extroverted parents have an introverted child. With a little mindfulness and understanding, any parent can have a good fit with any kind of child, says Dr. Miller. But parents need to step back from their own preferences and and see what the world looks like to their quiet children. Take the case of Joyce and her 7-year-old daughter, Isabel. Isabel is an elfin second grader who likes to wear glittery sandals and colorful rubber bracelets snaking up her skinny arms. She has several best friends with whom she exchanges confidences, and she gets along with most of the kids in her class. She's the type to throw her arms around a classmate who's had a bad day. She even gives her birthday presents away to charity. That's why her mother, Joyce, an attractive, good-natured woman with a wise-cracking sense of humor and a bring-it-on demeanor, was so confused by Isabel's problems at school. In first grade, Isabel often came home consumed with worry over the class bully, who hurled mean comments at anyone sensitive enough to feel bruised by them. Even though the bully usually picked on other kids, Isabel spent hours dissecting the meaning of the bully's words, what her true intentions had been, even what the bully might be suffering at home that could possibly motivate her to behave so dreadfully at school. By second grade, Isabel started asking her mother not to arrange playdates without checking with her first. Usually, she preferred to stay home. When Joyce picked up Isabel from school, she often found the other girls gathered into groups and Isabel off on the playground, shooting baskets by herself. She just wasn't in the mix. "I had to stop doing pickups for a while," recalls Joyce. "It was just too upsetting for me to watch." Joyce couldn't understand why her sweet, loving daughter wanted to spend so much time alone. She worried that something was wrong with Isabel. Despite what she'd always thought about her daughter's empathetic nature, might Isabel lack the ability to relate with others? It was only when I suggested that Joyce's daughter might be an introvert, and explained what that was, that Joyce started thinking differently about Isabel's experiences at school. And from Isabel's perspective, things didn't sound alarming at all. "I need a break after school," she told me later. "School is hard because a lot of people are in the room, so you get tired. I freak out if my mom plans a play date without telling me because I don't want to hurt my friend's feelings, but I'd rather stay home. At a friend's house, you have to do the things other people want to do. I like hanging out with my mom after school because I can learn from her. She's been alive longer than me. We have thoughtful conversations. I like having thoughtful conversations because they make people happy." Some who read this book before publication commented that the quote from Isabel couldn't possibly be accurate. No second grader talks that way. But this is what she said. Isabel is telling us, in all her second grade wisdom, that introverts relate to other people. Of course they do. They just do it in their own way. Now that Joyce understands Isabel's needs, mother and daughter brainstorm happily, figuring out strategies to help Isabel navigate her school day. Before, I would have had Isabel going out and seeing people all the time, packing her time after school full of activities, says Joyce. Now I understand that it's very stressful for her to be in school, so we figure out together how much socializing makes sense and when it should happen. Joyce doesn't mind when Isabel wants to hang out alone in her room after school, or leave a birthday party a little earlier than the other kids. She also understands that since Isabel doesn't see any of this as a problem, there's no reason that she should. Joyce has also gained insight into how to help her daughter manage playground politics. Once, Isabel was worried about how to divide her time among three friends who didn't get along with each other. "My initial instinct," says Joyce, "would be to say, 'Don't worry about it. Just play with them all.' But now I understand that Isabel's a different kind of person. She has trouble strategizing about how to handle all these people simultaneously on the playground. So we talk about who she's going to play with and when, and we rehearse things she can tell her friends to smooth the situation over." Another time, when Isabel was a little older, she felt upset because her friends sat at two different tables in the lunchroom. One table was populated with her quieter friends, the other with the class extroverts. Isabel described the second group as loud, talking all the time, sitting on top of each other. Ugh! But she was sad because her best friend Amanda loved to sit at the crazy table, even though she was also friends with the girls at the more relaxed and chill table. Isabel felt torn. Where should she sit? Joyce's first thought was that the crazy table sounded like more fun. But she asked Isabel what she preferred. Isabel thought for a minute and said, Maybe every now and then I'll sit with Amanda. But I do like being quieter and taking a break at lunch from everything. Why would you want to do that? Thought Joyce. But she caught herself before she said it out loud. Sounds good to me, she told Isabel. And Amanda still loves you. She just really likes that other table. But it doesn't mean she doesn't like you. And you should get yourself the peaceful time you need. Understanding introversion, says Joyce, has changed the way she parents, and she can't believe it took her so long. When I see Isabel being her wonderful self, I value it, even if the world may tell her she should want to be at that other table. In fact, looking at that table through her eyes, it helps me reflect on how I might be perceived by others, and how I need to be aware and manage my extroverted default so as not to miss the company of others like my sweet daughter. Joyce has also come to appreciate Isabel's sensitive ways. Isabel is an old soul, she says. You forget that she's only a child. When I talk to her, I'm not tempted to use that special tone of voice that people reserve for children, and I don't adapt my vocabulary. I talk to her the way I would to any adult. She's very sensitive, very caring. She worries about other people's well-being. She can be easily overwhelmed, but all these things go together, and I love this about my daughter. Joyce is as caring a mother as I've seen, but she had a steep learning curve as parent to her daughter because of their difference in temperaments. Would she have enjoyed a more natural parent-child fit if she'd been an introvert herself? Not necessarily. Introverted parents can face challenges of their own. Sometimes painful childhood memories can get in the way. Emily Miller, a clinical social worker in Ann Arbor, Michigan, told me about a little girl she treated, Ava, whose shyness was so extreme that it prevented her from making friends or from concentrating in class. Recently, she sobbed when asked to join a group singing in front of the classroom, and her mother, Sarah, decided to seek Miller's help. When Miller asked Sarah, a successful business journalist, to act as a partner in Ava's treatment, Sarah burst into tears. She'd been a shy child, too, and felt guilty that she'd passed on to Ava her terrible burden. I hide it better now, but I'm still just like my daughter, she explained. I can approach anyone, but only as long as I'm behind a journalist's notebook. Sarah's reaction is not unusual for the pseudo-extrovert parent of a shy child, says Miller. Not only is Sarah reliving her own childhood, but she's projecting onto Ava the worst of her own memories. But Sarah needs to understand that she and Ava are not the same person, even if they do seem to have inherited similar temperaments. For one thing, Ava is influenced by her father, too, and by any number of environmental factors, so her temperament is bound to have a different expression. Sarah's own distress need not be her daughter's, and it does Ava a great disservice to assume that it will be. With the right guidance, Ava may get to the point where her shyness is nothing more than a small and infrequent annoyance. But even parents who still have work to do on their own self-esteem can be enormously helpful to their kids, according to Miller. Advice from a parent who appreciates how a child feels is inherently validating. If your son is nervous on the first day of school, it helps to tell him that you felt the same way when you started school, and still do sometimes at work, but that it gets easier with time. Even if he doesn't believe you, you'll signal that you understand and accept him. You can also use your empathy to help you judge when to encourage him to face his fears and when this would be too overwhelming. For example, Sarah might know that singing in front of the classroom really is too big a step to ask Ava to take all at once. But she might also sense that singing in private with a small and simpatico group or with one trusted friend is a manageable first step, even if Ava protests at first. She can, in other words, sense when to push Ava, and how much. The psychologist Elaine Aron, whose work on sensitivity I described in Chapter 6, offers insight into these questions when she writes about Jim, one of the best fathers she knows. Jim is a carefree extrovert with two young daughters. The first daughter, Betsy, is just like him, but the second daughter, Lily, is more sensitive, a keen but anxious observer of her world. Jim is a friend of Aaron's, so he knew all about sensitivity and introversion. He embraced Lily's way of being, but at the same time, he didn't want her to grow up shy. So, writes Aaron, he became determined to introduce her to every potentially pleasurable opportunity in life, from ocean waves, tree climbing and new foods, to family reunions, soccer, and varying her clothes rather than wearing one comfortable uniform. In almost every instance, Lily initially thought these novel experiences were not such good ideas, and Jim always respected her opinion. He never forced her, although he could be very persuasive. He simply shared his view of a situation with her, the safety and pleasures involved, the similarities to things she already liked. He would wait for that little gleam in her eye that said she wanted to join in with the others, even if she couldn't yet. Jim always assessed these situations carefully, to ensure that she would not ultimately be frightened, but rather be able to experience pleasure and success. Sometimes he held her back until she was overly ready. Above all, he kept it an internal conflict, not a conflict between him and her. And if she or anyone else comments on her quietness or hesitancy, Jim's prompt reply is, "That's just your style. Other people have different styles, but this is yours. You like to take your time and be sure." Jim also knows that part of her style is befriending anyone whom others tease, doing careful work, noticing everything going on in the family, and being the best soccer strategist in her league. One of the best things you can do for an introverted child is to work with him on his reaction to novelty. Remember that introverts react not only to new people, but also to new places and events. So don't mistake your child's caution in new situations for an inability to relate to others. He's recoiling from novelty or overstimulation, not from human contact. As we saw in the last chapter, introversion-extroversion levels are not correlated with either agreeableness or the enjoyment of intimacy. Introverts are just as likely as the next kid to seek others' company, though often in smaller doses. The key is to expose your child gradually to new situations and people, taking care to respect his limits, even when they seem extreme. This produces more confident kids than either overprotection or pushing too hard. Let him know that his feelings are normal and natural, but also that there's nothing to be afraid of. "I know it can feel funny to play with someone you've never met, but I bet that boy would love to play trucks with you if you asked him." Go at your child's pace. Don't rush him. If he's young, make the initial introductions with the other little boy if you have to. And stick around in the background. Or, when he's really little, with a gentle, supportive hand on his back, for as long as he seems to benefit from your presence. When he takes social risks, let him know you admire his efforts. "I saw you go up to those new kids yesterday. I know that can be difficult, and I'm proud of you." The same goes for new situations. Imagine a child who's more afraid of the ocean than are other kids the same age. Thoughtful parents recognize that this fear is natural and even wise. The ocean is indeed dangerous. But they don't allow her to spend the summer on the safety of the dunes, and neither do they drop her in the water and expect her to swim. Instead, they signal that they understand her unease while urging her to take small steps. Maybe they play in the sand for a few days, with the ocean waves crashing at a safe distance. Then one day they approach the water's edge, perhaps with the child riding on a parent's shoulders. They wait for calm weather or low tide to immerse a toe, then a foot, then a knee. They don't rush. Every small step is a giant stride in a child's world. When ultimately she learns to swim like a fish, she has reached a crucial turning point in her relationship not only with water, but also with fear. Slowly your child will see that it's worth punching through her wall of discomfort to get to the fun on the other side. She'll learn how to do the punching by herself. As Dr. Kenneth Rubin, the director of the Center for Children, Relationships, and Culture at the University of Maryland, writes, "If you're consistent in helping your young child learn to regulate his or her emotions and behaviors in soothing and supportive ways, something rather magical will begin to happen. In time, you might watch your daughter seem to be silently reassuring herself. "Those kids are having fun. I can go over there." He or she is learning to self-regulate fearfulness and wariness. If you want your child to learn these skills, don't let her hear you call her shy. She'll believe the label and experience her nervousness as a fixed trait, rather than an emotion she can control. She also knows full well that shy is a negative word in our society. Above all, do not shame her for her shyness. If you can, it's best to teach your child self-coaxing skills while he's still very young, when there's less stigma associated with social hesitancy. Be a role model by greeting strangers in a calm and friendly way, and by getting together with your own friends. Similarly, invite some of his classmates to your house. Let him know gently that when you're together with others, it's not okay to whisper or tug at your pants leg to communicate his needs. He needs to speak up. Make sure that his social encounters are pleasant by selecting kids who aren't overly aggressive and play groups that have a friendly feel to them. Have your child play with younger kids if this gives him confidence, older kids if they inspire him. If he's not clicking with a particular child, don't force it. You want most of his early social experiences to be positive. Arrange for him to enter new social situations as gradually as possible. When you're going to a birthday party, for example, talk in advance about what the party will be like and how the child might greet her peers. First, I'll say, "Happy birthday, Joey," and then I'll say, "Hi, Sabrina." And make sure to get there early. It's much easier to be one of the earlier guests, so your child feels as if other people are joining him in a space that he owns, rather than having to break into a pre-existing group. Similarly, if your child is nervous before school starts for the year, bring him to see his classroom and, ideally, to meet the teacher one-on-one, as well as other friendly-looking adults, such as principals and guidance counselors, janitors and cafeteria workers. You can be subtle about this. "I've never seen your new classroom. Why don't we drive by and take a look?" Figure out together where the bathroom is, what the policy is for going there, the route from the classroom to the cafeteria, and where the school bus will pick him up at day's end. Arrange playdates during the summer with compatible kids from his class. You can also teach your child simple social strategies to get him through uncomfortable moments. Encourage him to look confident, even if he's not feeling it. Three simple reminders go a long way. Smile, stand up straight, and make eye contact. Teach him to look for friendly faces in a crowd. Bobby, a 3-year-old, didn't like going to his city preschool because at recess, the class left the safe confines of the classroom and played on the roof with the bigger kids in the older classes. He felt so intimidated that he wanted to go to school only on rainy days when there was no roof time. His parents helped him figure out which kids he felt comfortable playing with, and to understand that a noisy group of older boys didn't have to spoil his fun. If you think that you're not up to all this, or that your child could use extra practice, ask a pediatrician for help locating a social skills workshop in your area. These workshops teach kids how to enter groups, introduce themselves to new peers, and read body language and facial expressions. And they can help your child navigate what for many introverted kids is the trickiest part of their social lives, the school day. It's a Tuesday morning in October, and the 5th grade class at a public school in New York City is settling down for a lesson on the 3 branches of American government. The kids sit cross-legged on a rug in a brightly lit corner of the room, while their teacher, perched on a chair with a textbook in her lap, takes a few minutes to explain the basic concepts. Then it's time for a group activity applying the lesson. "This classroom gets so messy after lunch," says the teacher. "There's bubblegum under the tables, food wrappers everywhere, and cheese nips all over the floor. We don't like our room to be so messy, do we?" The students shake their heads no. "Today we're going to do something about this problem, together," says the teacher. She divides the class into 3 groups of 7 kids each, a legislative group, tasked with enacting a law to regulate lunchtime behavior, an executive group, which must decide how to enforce the law, and a judicial branch, which has to come up with a system for adjudicating messy eaters. The kids break excitedly into their groups, seating themselves in three large clusters. There's no need to move any furniture. Since so much of the curriculum is designed for group work, the classroom desks are already arranged in pods of seven desks each. The room erupts in a merry din. Some of the kids who'd looked deathly bored during the 10-minute lecture are now chattering with their peers, but not all of them. When you see the kids as one big mass, they look like a room full of joyfully squirming puppies. But when you focus on individual children, like Maya, a redhead with a ponytail, wire-rimmed glasses, and a dreamy expression on her face, you get a strikingly different picture. In Maya's group, the executive branch, everyone is talking at once. Maya hangs back. Samantha, tall and plump in a purple t-shirt, takes charge. She pulls a sandwich bag from her knapsack and announces, "Whoever's holding the plastic bag gets to talk." The students pass around the bag, each contributing a thought in turn. They remind me of the kids in The Lord of the Flies, civic-mindedly passing around their conch shell, at least until all hell breaks loose. Maya looks overwhelmed when the bag makes its way to her. "I agree," she says, handing it like a hot potato to the next person. The bag circles the table several times. Each time, Maya passes it to her neighbor, saying nothing. Finally, the discussion is done. Maya looks troubled. She's embarrassed, I'm guessing, that she hasn't participated. Samantha reads from her notebook a list of enforcement mechanisms that the group has brainstormed. "Rule number one," she says, "if you break the laws, you miss recess." "Wait," interrupts Maya. "I have an idea." "Go ahead," says Samantha, a little impatiently. But Maya, who, like many sensitive introverts, seems attuned to the subtlest cues for disapproval, notices the sharpness in Samantha's voice. She opens her mouth to speak, but lowers her eyes, only managing something rambling and unintelligible. No one can hear her. No one tries. The cool girl in the group, light years ahead of the rest in her slinkiness and fashion-forward clothes, sighs dramatically. Maya peters off in confusion, and the cool girl says, "Okay, Samantha, you can keep reading the rules now." The teacher asks the executive branch for a recap of its work. Everyone vies for airtime. Everyone except Maya. Samantha takes charge as usual, her voice carrying over everyone else's until the rest of the group falls silent. Her report doesn't make a lot of sense, but she's so confident and good-natured that it doesn't seem to matter. Maya, for her part, sits curled up at the periphery of the group, writing her name over and over again in her notebook in big block letters as if to reassert her identity, at least to herself. Earlier, Maya's teacher had told me that she's an intellectually alive student who shines in her essay writing. She's a gifted softball player, and she's kind to others, offering to tutor other children who lag behind academically. But none of Maya's positive attributes were evident that morning. Any parent would be dismayed to think that this was their child's experience of learning, of socializing, and of herself. Maya is an introvert. She is out of her element in a noisy and overstimulating classroom where lessons are taught in large groups. Her teacher told me that she'd do much better in a school with a calm atmosphere, where she could work with other kids who are equally hardworking and attentive to detail, and where a larger portion of the day would involve independent work. Maya needs to learn to assert herself in groups, of course, but will experiences like the one I witnessed teach her this skill? The truth is that many schools are designed for extroverts. Introverts need different kinds of instruction from extroverts, write College of William and Mary education scholars Jill Burris and Lisa Kenzig. And too often, very little is made available to that learner except constant advice on becoming more social and gregarious. We tend to forget that there's nothing sacrosanct about learning in large group classrooms, and that we organize students this way not because it's the best way to learn, but because it's cost-efficient. And what else would we do with our children while the grown-ups are at work? If your child prefers to work autonomously and socialize one-on-one, there's nothing wrong with her. She just happens not to fit the prevailing model. The purpose of school should be to prepare kids for the rest of their lives. But too often what kids need to be prepared for is surviving the school day itself. The school environment can be highly unnatural, especially from the perspective of an introverted child who loves to work intensely on projects he cares about and hang out with one or two friends at a time. In the morning, the door to the bus opens and discharges its occupants in a noisy, jostling mass. Academic classes are dominated by group discussions in which a teacher prods him to speak up. He eats lunch in the cacophonous din of the cafeteria, where he has to jockey for a place at a crowded table. Worst of all, there's little time to think or create. The structure of the day is almost guaranteed to sap his energy, rather than stimulate it. Why do we accept this one-size-fits-all situation as a given, when we know perfectly well that adults don't organize themselves this way? We often marvel at how introverted, geeky kids blossom into secure and happy adults. We liken it to a metamorphosis. However, maybe it's not the children who change, but their environments. As adults, they get to select the careers, spouses, and social circles that suit them. They don't have to live in whatever culture they're plunked into. Research from a field known as person-environment fit shows that people flourish when, in the words of psychologist Brian Little, they're engaged in occupations, roles, or settings that are concordant with their personalities. The inverse is also true. Kids stop learning when they feel emotionally threatened. No one knows this better than Luann Johnson, a tough-talking former Marine and schoolteacher, widely recognized for educating some of the most troubled teens in the California public school system. Michelle Pfeiffer played her in the movie Dangerous Minds. I visited Johnson at her home in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, to find out more about her experience teaching children of all stripes. Johnson happens to be skilled at working with very shy children, which is no accident. One of her techniques is to share with her students how timid she herself used to be. Her earliest school memory is of being made to stand on a stool in kindergarten because she preferred to sit in the corner and read books, and the teacher wanted her to interact. Many shy children are thrilled to discover that their teacher had been as shy as they were, she told me. I remember one very shy girl in my high school English class whose mother thanked me for telling her daughter that I believed she would peak much later in life, so not to worry that she didn't shine in high school. She said that one comment had changed her daughter's entire outlook on life. Imagine, one offhand comment made such an impact on a tender child. When encouraging shy children to speak, says Johnson, it helps to make the topic so compelling that they forget their inhibitions. She advises asking students to discuss hot-button subjects like, "Boys have life a lot easier than girls do." Johnson, who is a frequent public speaker on education, despite a lifelong public speaking phobia, knows firsthand how well this works. "I haven't overcome my shyness," she says. "It is sitting in the corner, calling to me. But I am passionate about changing our schools, so my passion overcomes my shyness once I get started on a speech. If you find something that arouses your passion or provides a welcome challenge, you forget yourself for a while. It's like an emotional vacation. But don't risk having children make a speech to the class unless you've provided them with the tools to know with reasonable confidence that it will go well. Have kids practice with a partner and in small groups, and if they're still too terrified, don't force it." Experts believe that negative public speaking experiences in childhood can leave children with a lifelong terror of the podium. So what kind of school environment would work best for the Mayas of the world? First, some thoughts for teachers. Don't think of introversion as something that needs to be cured. If an introverted child needs help with social skills, teach her or recommend training outside class, just as you do for a student who needs extra attention in math or reading. But celebrate these kids for who they are. The typical comment on many children's report cards is, "I wish Molly would talk more in class." Pat Adams, the former head of the Emerson School for Gifted Students in Ann Arbor, Michigan, told me. But here we have an understanding that many kids are introspective. We try to bring them out, but we don't make it a big deal. We think about introverted kids as having a different learning style. Studies show